Okay, I want to dedicate the shir to Ilui Nishmas Chaya Miriam Batzvi Hirsch.
Okay. I want to cover a topic that is not a specific mitzvah, but since we've been learning about the various components of the Mishkan and the construction of the Mishkan, I want to speak about something that has to do with mitzvahs in general. The three stages of performing a mitzvah that I think are reflected by the three stages in the construction of the Mishkan. We've had since Parshas Truma, Parshios Truma, Tetzaveh, parts of Kisisa, Vayakel and Pekudei, basically four full sedras that deal with the Mishkan. The Torah is never so verbose. Why? Why here? So I think that if you look, you'll see that there are three different aspects of the Mishkan that are dealt with in these parshios. Truma and Tetzaveh is the Ribbono Shel Olam teaching Moshe Rabbeinu the laws, the makeup of the Mishkan. That's the learning stage. Every mitzvah starts with learning about it. Okay, and the Mishkan and the Big Day Kahuna. Truma is Moshe Rabbeinu learning, and in Tetzaveh, the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Moshe Rabbeinu to eventually teach it to the Jewish people. Okay, Vayakel and part of Pekudei is Moshe Rabbeinu commanding the Jewish people to do what he learned, and the actual construction of the components of the Mishkan. And the end of Pekudei is putting it all together. And the goal, having the Mishkan operable and the Shechina residing in the Mishkan. That's how this week's Sedra ends. U'kvod Hashem moleis ha-Mishkan, that God's presence filled the Mishkan. Now, we say every day, we ask God to give us the power lilmod u'lelamed, lishmor v'lasos u'lekayem. Those are the three different stages of performance of a mitzvah. There's lilmod u'lelamed, learning and teaching, because a person who learns has to want to disseminate that knowledge and share it with others. So that's learning. Learning and teaching go together. Lilmod u'lelamed. Then there's lishmor v'lasos. Lishmor means to observe and not transgress the negative commandments. And lasos means to do the positive commandments. So that's the action part of the mitzvah. And then l'kayay means to fulfill the result of what that mitzvah is supposed to teach me, which we'll get to. We'll explain what that is in the as we proceed. So I want to discuss, in place of discussing any specific mitzvah, discuss these three aspects of every mitzvah and see what their significance is. Let's start with the learning part. Okay. So the simplest idea, Chazal say, the Gedola Talmud, learning is very great, Shemidiyah Lidei Maisa, because learning brings you to action. The simplest level of understanding, that is, that if you don't know what to do, you can't do it. So until you learn the halachas of any mitzvah, you learn the way to do it, how it's supposed to be done, right? You learn the process, what's involved, you can't do a mitzvah. So therefore, limud, talmud, mivia, lidei maisa, is the most simplest idea that learning brings you to be able to do the mitzvah. However, and when you learn, you should learn with such clarity that you are mentally involved with that mitzvah as if you are living it already. That's how strong the learning has to be. An example, something to do with Purim. The Medrash says that whenever, I don't remember who it was, whenever one of the Amoraim would come to the Pasuk in Megillas Esther that mentioned Nebuchadnezzar, right, Asher Hegla Mirushalayim, Im Hagola Asher Hoglasa, Im Yechonia Melech Yehuda, Asher Hegla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, in describing Mordechai, it says he was exiled with the exiles who were exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. So when he mentioned Nebuchadnezzar in Megillas Esther, he would say, Nebuchadnezzar shochit tamya, may his bones be ground up, cursed him. So the Medrash questions, why only in Megillas Esther? Nebuchadnezzar is only mentioned once in Megillas Esther, but he's mentioned numerous times in Sefer Yirmiyah. Did he do it there or not? So the Medrash says no. In Yirmiyah, Nebuchadnezzar was still alive. And you're not allowed to curse a living king. But in Megillas Esther, that was after Nebuchadnezzar died. That's when Megillas Esther happened. And therefore, he could curse him. The obvious question is, when this Amora learned Yirmiyah, Nebuchadnezzar was dead years before. Right? He was alive when Yirmiyah was alive. But he wasn't alive when this Amora was learning Yirmiyah. What do you see from there? That when you learn Yirmiyahu, you have to live it. You have to transport yourself into the era of Yirmiyahu, and you're like you're going back into time and living what you're learning. And therefore, when you're living Yirmiyahu, you can't curse Nebuchadnezzar. When you're living Megillas Esther, Nebuchadnezzar's already dead. You can curse him. I'll let you ask questions afterwards. Okay. And therefore, also, we find that even the Rabbanu Shel Olam, who taught Moshe Rabbeinu all about the Mishkan, taught him in a way that he could see literal visual aids, because what a person sees is more clear to him. A picture is worth a thousand words is a truism. It's Torahdik, right? It says that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't sure how the new moon should look, and so God showed him a new moon, right? An example. He wasn't sure of how the shekel, right, could possibly a half shekel atone. So he showed him a half shekel of fire. He wasn't sure about, how the menorah should look. God showed him. Okay? In fact, the whole Mishkan, it doesn't say Asher Lamadita Bahar, how you learned it on the mountain. Asher Horesa Bahar, as you were shown. God actually showed Moshe Rabbeinu these visual aids. Because even Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest of all the prophets, couldn't understand something as well as if he saw it before his eyes, right, than if he just was explained to him intellectually. Even the Rabbanu Shel Olam could not explain to Moshe Rabbeinu as well intellectually in words as he could by showing him the object itself, by showing a picture. That's why when Moshe Rabbeinu taught Bnei Israel about the animals, he showed them. Now he showed them, this is the animals you can eat. He took them and he pointed to them. This is what the animal looks like. And not only that, but a person is more affected by what he sees than what he knows intellectually. Okay? One example of that, the Sefer HaIkarim says, Rabbi Yosef Albo. He says that Moshe Rabbeinu was given a blow-by-blow description of what was happening at the foot of Har Sinai when the Jewish people were serving the golden calf. Yet he didn't break the luchos until he descended and saw it for himself. Now, why, he didn't trust God? He believed it more when he saw it? Of course not. He believed it the same way as when he heard it from God. But people are moved to action by what they see, not what they know. Right? It's much more real to a person. It's much more, it's more inspiring. It's moving when you see something rather than you just know it intellectually. Not only that, but sometimes what you know intellectually, right, doesn't affect you as much as that you had seen it. Another proof to that. It says, one of the reasons that the Rabbanu Shel Olam brought the plague of darkness upon the Jewish people, upon the Egyptians, was because there were Jews who had to die in Egypt. And God didn't want Paro and the Egyptians to see Jews dying, because they would have said, you see, it's not just us. This is just a Makas Medina. It's nothing to do with God. It's something, you know, some bad plague that's going on over here. So therefore, the Rabbanu Shel Olam made the Jews die during darkness when they couldn't see it. Now, I would understand that if like 10, 15 Jews died during Makas Choshech, and nobody ever noticed it. But according to Chazal, 4/5 of the Jewish people died during the plague of Choshech. That means before the lights went out, there were 3 million Jews of men between 20 and 60 in Egypt. 6 days later, lights go back on, and there are 600,000 males between 20 and 60, and the cemeteries are full with fresh graves. You don't have to be too smart to deduce what happened, right? So what did God gain by killing the Jews during darkness when it was obvious when the lights went on? What happened? The answer is that seeing Jews dying makes more of an impression than deducing it. Deducing it, they knew, but it wouldn't make the same impression on them. And therefore, God didn't want them to see Jews dying. He wanted to deduce, fine, but it's not the same thing. Therefore, learning about something and learning it intensely is the first stage in doing it. It makes it real to you, makes it clear to you, you know the details, now you're able to actually do it. So limud is great because it brings you to action in the most simplest form. But there are greater, deeper ideas of how learning brings you to action. According to this idea that we've said, it's only if you learn about the mitzvah itself. You learn the details, you learn the impact, and then, what's it called, you can do it. But what if you learn something else? You learn Torah that's abstract, not lemaisa. Does that bring you to action? So we'll see yes, because there are other levels of where learning brings to action, even if you're not learning about that mitzvah specifically. First thing. It says, Barasi Yetzer Hara, Barasi Torah Tavlin. I created the Yetzer Hara, and I created the Torah as an antidote. That means if you learn Torah, it helps you control your Yetzer Hara. Now, a person who can't control his Yetzer Hara is going to transgress negative commandments and not fulfill positive commandments. So by learning Torah, even Torah that has nothing to do with what you're fulfilling, just stop. Learning the abstract Torah helps you control your Yetzer Hara, which enables you to do mitzvahs. Because if you can't control your Yetzer Hara, you're going to not get mitzvahs you're not going to do. And averas you're going to do. It's one thing. Secondly, it says, in ein Torah, ein derech eretz. Without Torah, a person can't really perfect his character traits. Okay? You can go to a certain point, and in a certain way, if you don't have those basic character traits, you won't have Torah either. But if you have the basic character traits, and then you have Torah, you'll be able to reach much more refined levels of character. The more refined a person is, the more noble the mitzvahs he does, right? The more refined a person, the more refined his actions. The higher level the mitzvah is. Another thing, Torah itself brings you closer to God. Torah is a manner to know God, to come closer to Him. When you learn Torah, it's like learning God's will, God's mind. So you're learning with Him. You're learning with God. Learning Torah is like having a chavrusa with God. Having a study partner with God. So the more Torah you learn, the closer you come to God. And therefore, when you do a mitzvah, you do it with more kavana, with more intention, with nobler feelings or whatever. So the mitzvah is a different mitzvah. That's why you do the mitzvah with greater holiness. So that's why Gedola Talmud, learning, is so great that it brings you to action. Doesn't only mean enables you to do the mitzvah because now you know what it is. But it enables you to do the mitzvah because it takes away your Yetzer Hara. It makes you do the mitzvah in a much more exalted, refined way because it refines and exalts your personality. And it makes you closer to God, so when you do the mitzvah, you'll do it with greater holiness and greater intention. And that's why we find that the Pasuk says that you'll be able to distinguish Vein Ha'oved Elokim Ulevein Asher Lo Avado. The one who serves God and the one who didn't serve Him. And the Gemara comments on that, Eino Dome, Mishishana Pirko Meyaponim, Lishona Pirko Meyaponim Ve'echad. There's no comparison between a person who learned something 100 times and the one who learned it 101 times. But we're talking about serving God. I'm talking about learning Torah. It says the one who serves Him, right, and the one who doesn't serve Him. The one who serves Him is the 101 time guy. And the one who doesn't serve Him comparatively is the 100 time guy. But the idea is that the more you learn, the deeper you learn, so the more your mitzvahs are a quality mitzvahs. And the difference is that if it's a mitzvah that comes from 101 times learning, compared to that kind of mitzvah, a mitzvah that comes from 100 times learning is called not service of God at all. It's in comparison, right, nothing. So the more that a person learns Torah, the higher caliber his mitzvahs are. Right? For sure, you can imagine somebody who puts on tefillin and knows nothing more than just the basic rote halachas of how to put tefillin on, and somebody who knows all the ideas behind tefillin, all the halachas of tefillin, and all the pilpulim about tefillin, obviously his mitzvah of tefillin, when he puts the tefillin on his arm, is going to be a much deeper, more significant, more quality kind of mitzvah than the person who doesn't know too much about tefillin altogether except how to put them on. And therefore, Parshios, Truma, and Tetzave, Truma represents one aspect of learning, because that's what Truma was. Moshe Rabbeinu was on the mountain learning the laws and the construction of the Mishkan. It was a learning process. He wasn't speaking to the Jewish people at all. This is right after the Torah was given. Moshe Rabbeinu was up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and God spoke to him and learned with him these parshios. Had nothing to do with the Jewish people yet. So Moshe Rabbeinu was learning, and that's Truma. Truma is that which exalts you, uplifts you, inspires you. People who are uplifted and inspired to give to the Mishkan, but it also hints to the learning. The learning uplifts you, inspires you, moves you to be able to keep mitzvahs properly. So that's Truma. And Tetzaveh is, if you learn, you have a responsibility to teach others too. Not just for yourself, but that exalted inspiration that you get from learning, share that with somebody else too. And not only that, Tetzaveh speaks about the lighting of the menorah, the getting of the oil to be able to light the menorah, which is a symbol of teaching Torah. Enlightening other people with the light of Torah, which is the oil, the olive oil represents Torah knowledge, and the light of Torah comes from somebody who lights a menorah and illuminates other people with Torah. So Truma represents the learning, and Tetzaveh the teaching of the Mishkan specifically, and what's it called? It symbolizes all learning as a precursor, as a preparation, as the first stage and basis for doing mitzvahs. Okay, so those are the first two parshios that deal with the Mishkan. Truma Tetzaveh symbolizes the learning aspect that precedes the doing aspect of a mitzvah. Okay, any questions on this part? I'll give you time for questions on each stage. Yeah. What? Because there's an idea, Shein Rishoyim Yirkav, that if you mention evil people, you should curse them to show that you abhor evil, not to have an effect on them, even though it may have a bad effect on his neshama anyway. Right? Nebuchadnezzar also had a neshama, who was probably burning in Gehenna till today. But in addition to that, there's an idea of making a statement. If you mention evil, curse it. Show that you can't be ambivalent to evil. Only after he's dead. Right. A king, I don't know if Hitler was a king, but a king, you're not allowed to curse when he's alive. Kings are king. When they're alive, God runs the hearts of kings. Okay, that's too much off the path. Okay, next. Yeah. Bitzalo. Yeah, also. But he, what's it called? Moshe Rabbeinu instructed him. And whether he was shown or not, or Moshe Rabbeinu told him what he was told. Moshe Rabbeinu instructed Bitzalo how to do it. And he probably showed him pictures of it too. Okay, but he was told to tell Bitzalo as he was shown on the mountain. I don't know if it says that Bitzalo was shown or not. Right, but even the tremendous wisdom, you still need to see it. So Moshe Rabbeinu maybe drew him a picture. Okay, now, that brings us to the second stage of fulfillment of mitzvahs, which is the actual physical fulfillment of the mitzvah itself, Lishmor V'lasos, which is observing and not transgressing the negative commandments, and doing the positive commandments. That is Vayakel. Now, the Meshach, why is that contained in the Sedra Vayakel, where it means Moshe gathered the people together? So I think that's significant in the following way. The Meshach Chochma, the Meir Simcha from Divinsk, says that twice in the Torah it says that the Jewish people said everything that God said we will do. Except one time it says, Vayanu kol ha'am yachdav, all the people said together, everything God said we will do. And the other time it says, all the people said, not together, everything God said we will do and we will learn. She says, why over here does it say together and here not? Here it says we'll do and we'll learn. Here it doesn't say we'll learn. So he says the following. It's impossible for any individual to do all the mitzvahs. Because you have to be a Kohen to do some, and a Levi to do others, and Yisrael to do others. And if you're a Kohen, you don't have the Yisrael, and the Yisrael doesn't have the Kohens. A man doesn't have women's mitzvahs. Women don't have men's mitzvahs. So it's impossible for any one individual to do all the mitzvahs. How is it possible that we should be able to do all the mitzvahs? So he says there's two ways. One is you can learn. What you can't do, learn about. And it's like you did it. So every individual can really do all the mitzvahs, some in practice and some by learning. Then you don't need everybody to be together. Everybody on their own as an individual can do all the mitzvahs, but some of them through learning. So when it says, Vayanu, kol ha'am, all the people answer, but it doesn't say yachtov, together, what does it say? Nas, kol ha'shedivra Hashem, everything God said, we'll do and we'll learn. The things we can do, we'll do, and the things we can't do, we'll learn about. But, he says, if you want to actually do it, not just learn about it, then you need all Jews to be considered connected. Then what I do helps for you, and what you do helps for me. So then it says, Vayanu kol ha'am yachtov, all the people said together, everything God said we will do. How can you possibly do it all? By being unified with other people, so your actions count for me and my actions count for you. Therefore, when it comes to the actual performance of mitzvahs, there's important vayakel, that there's a unity amongst the Jewish people. Moshe gathered them together, because not everybody's going to do everything. But between us all, as one entity, we do everything. In addition, when you're doing mitzvahs physically, there's an idea of eino dome, yachidosus ha-mitzvah l'rab mitzvah. That's talking about where people doing different mitzvahs, yet they're all considered doing everything because they're united. But even if we're all doing the same mitzvah, there's no comparison, Chazal say, from a individual who does a mitzvah alone and a rabbin, a community, does a mitzvah together, even though we're all doing the same thing. But there's a different quality of the mitzvah if it's done with greater quantities, with more people. Now, the mitzvah itself, since we're discussing now the actual physical performance of mitzvahs, the mitzvah itself, going through the motions, the physical performance of the mitzvah, has two purposes to it. In order to understand these purposes, go off the topic a little bit, still has to do so with the Mishkan, but to bring out these two purposes. It says that the Aron was overlaid with gold and inlaid with gold. It was wood. The Aron was a wooden box, wooden chest, that was covered with gold on the outside and covered on the inside. And that teaches us a lesson that a person, a Talmud Chacham, who's the Aron is the receptacle, right, the repository of the Torah, a Talmud Chacham is the repository of the Torah. So he's like the Aron. He should be gold on the inside, gold on the outside. Tocho kebaro. His inside should be like his outside. Okay? So, the way the rabbis describe that, which one comes first, the inside or the outside? The inside should be like the outside. No. Think again. The inside should be like the outside. Which one is first and which one then comes second? The outside's first, because the inside should be like the outside. That means the outside is there, and the inside should be like the outside. Okay? So first you have the outside, and then you make the inside conform to the outside. Inside like outside, which means the outside is already there. That seems difficult to understand, because we know that the inside is probably the more important thing. What kavana you have, what intentions you have, what you're thinking, not just doing the motions. Just the opposite. Doing the motions by itself is called mitzvah sanoshim ulumada. It's just rote, by habit. That's not so significant. So it should say, first worry about the inside. And then make sure the outside fits as the inside. But the inside is the most important thing to worry about. The answer is that that's not how a human being functions. I'll tell you a story which I'm sure I've told here before, but I'll tell you it again. I had a woman in my kahila in Miami who was becoming stronger in her observance of Torah. And she became more medactic in kashrus, and then in Shabbos, and so on. Right? She was a religious her whole life. She wasn't a balas tshuva, but she came from a family that were more or less very lax in how they kept the mitzvahs, and she started to do it much more seriously. So at one point, I felt that she really was ready to start to excel or be more observant in how she dressed. That she should dress more modestly. So I said to her, I think you're ready, you know, to start dressing more modestly. Right? And to keep the halacha the way it's supposed to be. So she told me, Rabbi, I don't feel inside like a Rebbetzin, and I don't want to look like a Rebbetzin. When I feel like a Rebbetzin, then I'll dress like one in order that I shouldn't be a hypocrite. So I said, you know what you can be compared to? Somebody who comes to shul on Simchas Torah, and he says, I'm really not happy. So I'm not going to get up there and dance because I'm a hypocrite. I'm going to dance, people think I'm happy, and inside I'm not happy. So I'm going to sit here and contemplate being happy, and as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance. So sit there till Tisha B'Av. Right? That's not how you get happy, by sitting and contemplating happiness. You know how you get happy? Dance. You'll dance, you'll get happy. So, the same thing. If you dress immodestly, you're never going to start thinking modest. You know how you get to think modest? By dressing modestly. Motions create emotions. That's how it works. That's the whole idea of mitzvahs maaseiyos. We have a religion where there's a lot of action, a lot of physical things we do. Right? Because, that's right, the chitzonios is ma'orer the pnimius. The inside takes the cue from the outside. It's hard to get your neshama moving. But if you get your body moving, that gets the neshama moving. I don't know if it's still true in cars today, but older cars used to have the ignition didn't turn on the motor. There was a starter motor. So the ignition, right, turns on the starter motor, and the starter motor can turn over the regular motor. Because it's hard. You can't, 12 volts, right, or whatever a car battery is, what's it called, can't turn over that big motor. But it can turn over a small motor that then starts up the big motor. Same thing. It's hard to get your neshama moving. It takes a lot to move your neshama. But your body, you can get moving. So get your body moving, your body will move your neshama. So it's the external that gets the internal moving. And therefore, it says, Toho Kibaro, that the outside comes first, and then hopefully after you get the outside in motion, it will create the emotions. And therefore we say, when we do a mitzvah, we make a bracha, Asher Kiddushanu Bim Mitzvosav. God makes us holier in the performance of the mitzvah itself. You're going through the motion of the mitzvah, it itself makes you feel holier. And then, okay. However, what would you say, though, once the person gets to that level, okay, he comes to Simchas Torah, he wants to be happy. So he starts to dance. The dancing makes him happy. Now, should he continue dancing? Right? Let's say now we know he never loses the happiness. So is there an idea to continue dancing or no? The dancing reached its purpose. I'm happy. The rest of the day I can sit here happy about the yontif, happy with God. I got my neshama moving because my body was moving. And now I can stop dancing. No. There's still an idea to continue dancing. Even if it won't bring you to more simcha. But there's a second aspect of the externals. And that is the following. The Ramban says on the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Im ta'iru v'im toreru esa'ava ad shetechpatz. If you have, he explains it in the following way. If you have a very fine feeling, inspiration, love of God, fear of God, some very high, noble, spiritual feeling, don't leave it external, spiritual alone, but put it into a chetetz, put it into something concrete. Express it in a quantified manner. Put it into something concrete, into something real, into something action. Put it into some chetetz, into some object. Okay? Because what a person puts into an object, what he quantifies physically, is more real than leaving it in an ethereal, spiritual state. So you start with the physical to get your kavana, to get your inspiration. Once you have the inspiration, you use the physical again to express it. So the physical's on both ends. And that explains something else. Explains, first of all, Ramban holds that the last stage of the world will be a physical world. But a physical world that people don't have to eat, drink, and do all the physical things, but they'll have a body. So the commentaries ask, why do you need a body if you don't need a body? What's the purpose of the body if you don't have to eat, drink, and do any bodily functions? What do you need a body for? The answer is, it says, but Moshe Cordovero says, that the neshamas in Gan Eden, who have left this world, now they're in a spiritual world, they look forward to Trias HaMesim, for the resurrection of the dead, when they'll get their bodies back, like we would look forward to Mashiach. You would think just the opposite. They'd be happy to be in a spiritual world. Being in a physical world is a lower level. The answer is not. Being in a physical world is a higher level. Because when you can express spirituality in physical terms, in a physical framework, it's more real. It's more concrete. So they're waiting for the day they'll be able to express the deep spiritual ideas of the neshama in a physical way. Therefore, in the time of Tchias HaMesim, Olam Haba, we won't need the body to move the neshama. The neshama will be able to move on its own. Won't need the body. But it'll need the body to express what it has, to put it into a, quantify it, to concretize it. With that, I wanted to explain a Gemara, which I think we've explained in the past, but do it again. The Gemara says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to build the Mishkan, so he told him to build a Mishkan, and then the Kelim, then the vessels. First the environment, the walls of the Mishkan, right, and then the various vessels that went inside. When Moshe Rabbeinu told Bezalel, he switched it around. And he told him first to build the vessels, then the Mishkan. So Bezalel said, Lo kach min hago shalolam. This is not the way of the world. Somebody doesn't build their furniture and then build their house. Because if I build the furniture first, where am I going to put it till I build the house? Must be that God told you the other way. He told you first to make the Mishkan and then the vessels, not vice versa. Moshe said, you know what? You were in the shadow of God and you knew. Because that's taka what he told me. Very difficult Gemara. Because what did Moshe Rabbeinu, why did he change it around? Did he make a mistake? That's unheard of. He couldn't make a mistake. If he made a mistake, then the whole Torah is in jeopardy. And if he did it on purpose, why do you want to fool Bezalel for? And secondly, shade is always a euphemism for doubt. Shadow of a doubt. Tzilo shel safek. Light is always a symbol of clarity. Borer kashemesh. It's clear as the sun. Okay? If Bezalel knew what God said, he wasn't in God's shadow. He was in God's light. Shadow always means something shady, not clear. Right? So why was he called Bezalel? Because he's Bezalel. He was in God's shadow. He should have been in God's light. He should have been called Orkel, not Bezalel. So what I want to say is the following. Before the sin of the golden calf, which is when Moshe Rabbeinu learned these parashios on the mountain, the people had not sinned yet. There was no sin of the golden calf. The Mishkan had one purpose to it, different than after the sin of the golden calf. Before the sin of the golden calf, people did not need a physical Mishkan to be inspired to feel God's presence. Wherever you were in the world, you could feel God's presence. You didn't need a special place to get you in the mood. Okay? The Mishkan did not have to fulfill that purpose of the externals arousing your internal feeling. You didn't need a mishkan to make you feel God's presence. B'chol makom asher azkir eshemi, avo eilecha v'rechticha. Wherever I mention my name, God said, this is before the sin of the golden calf, I'll come to you and bless you. You can feel me everywhere in the world. So why did you need a mishkan for? Because once you had that tremendous feeling of closeness to God, you came to the mishkan, and then everybody would have been a kohen. Every Jew could have been a kohen. The b'choros, the firstborn, would have had first shot at it. But every Jew could have been a kohen. And then you came to the mishkan, and you expressed the feeling you got everywhere in the world through the vessels of the mishkan. That was the second aspect of physicality. Expressing the spiritual, not arousing the spiritual. You didn't need to arouse the spiritual, but you needed to express it. So in that respect, which was more important? Not the mishkan, not the environment, but the kelim. Go and use those kelim. And then you'll create even a higher environment. So the kelim came first and then the mishkan. So when God told Moshe Rabbeinu to build the mishkan, it was before the sin of the golden calf. And God knew there was going to be a sin of the golden calf. So he actually told Moshe Rabbeinu to build the mishkan first and then the kelim. Because after the sin of the golden calf, you wouldn't be able to feel God's presence everywhere. You'd have to come first to the mishkan, be aroused by the physical externals of the mishkan to feel God's presence, and then use the kelim. Then Taka, the mishkan came first, then the kelim. So God, when he told Moshe, he told him the way that it would be after the sin, because he knew there was going to be a sin. But God's knowledge doesn't affect free choice. But human knowledge does. If Moshe would have known there's going to be a sin, it would have affected the free choice that the Jewish people had not to make that sin, or yes, to make it. So God couldn't tell Moshe Rabbeinu, I want you to build a mishkan and then kelim, because Moshe would say, why? We don't need a mishkan to arouse us to your presence. We got your presence everywhere. Must be that something's going to happen and the Jews are not going to be on that level. Must be there's going to be a sin. Moshe couldn't know that. So therefore, God told him in a way that appeared as if it would be first the kelim and then the mishkan, but he really said mishkan and kelim, but he shadowed it. He made it obscure. He said it in a way that was m'urpal. How do you say that in English? In a way that was unclear. Oblique. In an oblique way. Not clear. He wanted Moshe Rabbeinu to understand it one way so he wouldn't know there's going to be a sin, but he actually meant the other way. When he told it to Bezalel, it was after the sin. He came down from the mountain after Yom Kippur, after the sin, right? And he told Bezalel what he thought he had heard. Bezalel said, can't be. That's not the way that it is. The way after the sin of the golden calf, you need the mishkan first and the kelim. And I bet God told you that, but he said it in a shadowed, oblique way so you wouldn't understand it. You wouldn't know there's going to be a sin. That's what he said. You were in the shadow of God and you knew. You knew that God said this to me in a shadowed way and I didn't realize it. But now that you're saying it, now I realize that's really what God told me. But he didn't want me to understand it then. He wanted it to be shadowed and not clear, right? So I wouldn't know there's going to be a sin. But now it's obvious that that's what he meant. And where do we find, so it comes out that in the gold of the Aron, Toho Kebaro, right, that really they had outside, inside, outside again. It's exactly what the Torah says. The Torah says, V'tzipitha oso zahav tahar, you should overlay the ark with gold, mi bayis, inside, umichutz, and outside. Three levels. Outside, inside, outside. Where do we find three levels of overlaying and inlaying with gold? So I'll tell you, it's very simple. How did they make the Aron? They didn't spray it with gold paint. Okay? So how did they outlay it with gold? What they did is the following. Rashi says, they took a medium-sized box of wood. That was the Aron. A chest of wood. They made a larger box of thin gold and a smaller box of thin gold. First, they took the wooden box and they put it into the big gold box. So now the Aron is gold on the outside. The outside box covered the wood with gold. Then they took the little gold box and put it inside the wooden box. Now the inside of the Aron is gold. There's something missing, though. Where isn't there gold? Huh? On the rim. The rim. If you look down, you see gold, wood, gold. So now they had to cover the gold around the rim, so the whole thing would be covered. So you have outside, inside, and again outside.
That's how the Aron was made, and that symbolizes when you perform mitzvahs, so you first start with the outside, just get into it, even if you don't really mean it yet, you don't really feel it, that's how you get to feel it. A hypocrite is not somebody who's going through the motions and wants to get the emotions, but he doesn't have them yet. A hypocrite is somebody who doesn't want the emotions, he just wants to put on a show. That may be a hypocrite. But not somebody who wants to get happy by dancing. He's not a hypocrite. If he dances, he's not happy yet. And then, once you get that deep emotion from the physical, now again, express it in a physical way so it becomes concrete and real. Okay. So that is the fulfillment of the mitzvah. Now, that's the performance of the mitzvah. Now the fulfillment. The last thing is the end of Pikudei, the kiyum. The goal, God's presence filling the Mishkan and putting it all together, not just looking at a bunch of disjointed things, an Aron, a Shulchan, but it's a Mishkan that's functioning together to reach the goal of God's presence being around. And that goal has to be done by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu represents Torah. We're back to the Torah again. It's only within the framework of Torah that everything fits together. No individual thing has holiness by itself. It's only holy because it's in the framework of Torah. And I told you this story before, I'll tell you it again too. When I was in Miami, so I had a Bala boss who was in his, I guess, mid-70s at the time. He was basically functioning very nicely, but he had some kind of disease, chronic disease, that needed to be constantly monitored and medication. I think he had diabetes, but I'm not sure. And his wife called me on Tzom Gedalia one year, frantic. Saved my husband's life. My husband's going to kill himself. I knew the guy wasn't psychotic or anything. So it didn't sound right that he was going to kill himself. So I said, what's the problem? She said, we just came from the doctor. The doctor checked my husband. And he said that based on his condition, Baruch Hashem, it's under control. But he can't fast on Yom Kippur. Because if he fasts on Yom Kippur, he has a good chance he'll die. He has to eat 3 regular meals on Yom Kippur. When we left the doctor, my husband said that I haven't eaten on Yom Kippur since my bar mitzvah, and I don't plan to start now, and I'm going to fast. I don't care what the doctor says. And I'm afraid my husband's going to die. So do something. So I called the doctor, and I asked him, why do you think the doctor wasn't a religious man? Why do you think this man has to eat 3 meals? Yom Kippur's pretty serious, right? It's less a matter of life and death. He said, explained to me the exact situation, right, with all the medical reasons, and he told me if this man does not eat, this is what's going to happen, and he's going to be in danger of his life. I called a religious doctor and gave him the case scenario, right, the pathology of the case, and I said, what would you say about a man who has this condition or whatever, and these are the statistics, these are the factors, what would you tell him to do on Yom Kippur? He said, I tell him to eat 3 regular meals, because if this guy fasts even a little bit, he could die. I said, okay. So now 2 doctors now told me the same thing. Called the man in, and I said, I spoke to your wife, and I spoke to your doctor, and I spoke to another doctor. And everybody concurs that you must eat on Yom Kippur, 3 regular meals. He said, Rabbi, you're a nice man. You're about a third my age. I was a little younger then. And he said, you can't tell me what to do. Right? I'm a big boy, and I haven't eaten on Yom Kippur since my bar mitzvah. I'm not going to start this year. I respect you, but I'm fasting on Yom Kippur. I said, okay, you're right. I can't control your life, but I definitely can control the shul. And as soon as you leave my office, I'm going to call the gabbai and instruct him never to give you another honor in this shul, even, what's it called, to open the Aron Kodesh, even to look at the Aron Kodesh. You are persona non grata in this shul. He said, on what grounds? I said, because we may be lenient to give people who are not Shomer Shabbos aliyahs here and kibbudim, but we've never given an idol worshiper an honor here, and I don't plan to start now. You are an idol worshiper. He said, what are you talking about? I said, the God that we worship in this shul says that you have to eat on Yom Kippur. Now, you obviously don't worship that God because your God told you have to fast on Yom Kippur, okay? So I don't really care if you call your God Zeus, Jupiter, Chemosh, or Yom Kippur, right?
you obviously worship a different God than we do. Right? Because my God said you have to eat. Your God, the Yom Kippur God, said you have to fast. So we don't worship the Yom Kippur God in this shul. We worship the Rebbe Mishalom. You want to worship the Yom Kippur God? Gesundheit, hey, but don't do it in our shul. He ate on Yom Kippur. But that's exactly the point. Right? It's not that you have to fast on Yom Kippur because Yom Kippur is holy. You have to fast on Yom Kippur because the Torah said, because God said. But God said a lot of things. And it has to fit into the framework of the whole system. And if the same Torah that said you have to fast on Yom Kippur says that in danger to life, then you transgress most of the Torah, right? Because life takes precedence over the mitzvah, then that's what God wants. He wants you to eat on Yom Kippur, right? It's the same God. But if you take Yom Kippur and make it a value to itself, and don't look at it as part of the system of the Torah, then it becomes an idolatry. So no part of the Mishkan is holy until the whole thing is put together, and it's a whole system. And who is the one who governs that system? Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu represents the Torah. Only Moshe Rabbeinu could put the Mishkan together. So the putting it all together, it's not just a mitzvah here, a mitzvah there, but the mitzvahs have to be part of a system. And you have to look at the whole system to be knowing if you're doing God's will. In addition to that, and in that respect, anything could become an idolatry. Yom Kippur could be an idolatry. The Beis HaMikdash could be an idolatry. So Gemara says that they used to determine which Kohen would have the schus of starting the Avoda that day. He would have the first service in the Mikdash. Everybody wanted it. There was hundreds of Kohanim. And there's only a certain amount of Avodas. So not everybody could serve every day. So how did they decide who would get that schus? So they didn't have a gabbai with little index cards, right? They had the following. They had a race up the ramp of the Mizbeach. And they couldn't run. They had to go toe to heel, like at graduation, right? But what's it called? But they walked as fast as they could, toe to heel. And the one who got to the top first, he was the one who started the Avoda, and he picked the other ones to follow him. So one day, the Gemara says, there were two young Kohanim who were neck and neck. And one of them sees the other guy's getting ahead. So he takes out a knife and stabs the other guy in the heart. I mean, after all, you know, there's certain things you have to be willing to do to serve God. One of them is murder other people. So he stabbed him in the heart, and the guy was still living, but he was dying. He fell off the ramp, and he's dying in the throes of death. His father, the father of the victim, comes over, pulls the knife out of his son's heart, and he says, "Don't worry, I got the knife out before he died. The knife's still pure." That means they were more concerned about the purity of the knife than they were about murder. That's an Avodah Zarah. They made the temple into a cult. They made the Karbanos into an idol. That's not Torah. That's not part of the system. But they took sacrifices, temple, and took it out of the system, made it into a cult by itself. Anything could be a cult. Yerushalayim could be a cult, and Eretz Yisrael could be a cult, and the Mikdash could be a cult, and Yom Kippur could be a cult, as long as you don't look at it as part of the whole system. Once you take it out of the system and give it intrinsic value, then you go crazy. Right? I remember, and now I heard it again, when they evacuated Yamit, which was a terrible sorrow. Okay? We had to give it back to Egypt. Give it to Egypt. It's not even part of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? It's the Sinai Desert. But it was, we had control over it. Had to give it back. There was a group of yeshiva students that hold themselves up in a bunker and threaten to commit suicide if they give back Yamit. Now, does that fit into the system of the Torah? There's some kind of mitzvah to commit suicide if they give back Yamit? That's part of the system of the Torah? It's as much of the system of the Torah as somebody who says, "I'm going to fast on Yom Kippur, even though my life is in danger." No such thing. What? Masada was not according to Halach. What they did was wrong. Who honors them? The state of Israel. Right? The state of Israel honors a lot of things that are not Halach. In case you haven't noticed. The state of Israel does a lot of things that are Shalom Halach. Right? Masada, again, I don't want to besmirch the memory of the people of Masada. It depends why they did it. If they did it for the reasons that are purported, then it was wrong halachically. You don't commit suicide rather than living under Roman rule. If they were afraid they were going to be tortured by the Romans, if they were afraid they were going to be forced to do sins that they couldn't control after that, sins that you're supposed to give your life for, which is possible, because the Romans did that, okay, then it could be that they were allowed to commit suicide. No, no, no. There's halachic, right. There is a halachic basis, possibly, if a person's afraid that he may be tortured. You don't know. There was good chances they were holed up over there and the Romans were going to get them at some point. Right? Or that they'll be forced to do immoral things or whatever, which the Romans did, that there may be a halachic basis what they did could be right. Or maybe they thought they did something right. We're not judging them. But that's not what halacha says you should do. Okay. In any case, so that's one idea. Then there's another idea of this putting it all together. It's not just that everything has to be part of the system, but it's also there's more to the Torah than just doing a bunch of things. It's not a game. Do this, don't do that. You have to form your lifestyle, your values, your standards, your personality should be a Torah personality. Not that you have the goals, standards, values, lifestyle of the rest of the world, but you do it kosher, right? You live to eat, but you eat kosher. No, you have to eat to live, and kosher is supposed to teach you that. The Torah is not just a bunch of things to do in a secular lifestyle. It's to make a holy lifestyle. We're supposed to be a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. We're supposed to be a nation that represents God by living a holy existence. So the Torah is supposed to mold our behavior and our characters to be holy. And that's what it means, the Mishkan. The Mishkan is v'shachanti b'socham. God should dwell in the heart of every Jew. We're the Mishkan. The Mishkan is only the means for creating a totally holy society where a person's entire life surrounds around holiness. So therefore, the goal of it all is not just doing a bunch of mitzvahs. It's putting it all together and letting it influence your whole lifestyle, your personality, your character, everything you do should be done in order to have God dwell amongst us. To be that we should be representatives of God. We should be God's temple. We are the temple. And that was the bracha that Moshe Rabbeinu gave the Jewish people at the end, when all these three stages were finished, the learning, the performing, and the putting it all together. The Noam Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu, Umase Yodeinu Konenu Aleinu, Umase Yodeinu Konenehu. Meaning the following. The Noam Hashem. What is Noam Hashem? What's the sweetness of God? Drochero Darche Noam, the Chol Nesivoser Shalom. That's the Torah. First thing is the learning part. The Noam Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu. Let the sweetness of God, the learning of Torah, be upon us. That's the first stage in keeping the mitzvahs learning, like we explained. Umase yodeinu konino oleinu, and let the work of our hands establish us. Meaning, by going through the motions, you bring yourself to emotions. Let the work of our hands establish us and give us those important emotions. Umase yodeinu, and then like we said, koninehu. And then let us take those emotions and put them back into the work of our hands and concretize them. So far we have two levels, the way we explained it, and then Moshe Rabbeinu added a second bracha. Yiratzon shetishra shchina b'maisi yadeichem. May God's presence reside in what you made. In other words, don't just leave it building an aron, building a shulchan, separate disjoint things. Let God's presence permeate everything you do, because that's the goal of all of this. By doing all these separate mitzvahs, you have to then put it all together again and create an environment where God's presence is in everything you do and is reflected by everything you do. That's the goal of all of this. So we have Parshas Truma Tetzaveh, the learning part, Parshas Vayakel, and part of Pikudei, the performance part, and finally the end of Pikudei, the goal of it all, putting it all together and looking at it not as just disjointed things, but as an entire system together, which culminates in God's presence resting amongst the Jews.